Greetings and welcome, everyone. For those listening via recorded tape, do not adjust your set. I just a frog, but we'll get through it. You turn with me to Exodus 13. I titled this The Mixed Multitude. Exodus 13 is a culmination, really, of all the events that had taken place. In verse 1 we read, "And Yahweh spake unto Moses, saying, Sanctify unto me all of the firstborn. Whatsoever opens the womb among the children of Israel, both of man and of beast, it is mine." So the firstborn, not only of human beings, but of the animals, were considered Yahweh's. "And Moses said unto the people, Remember this day in which you came out from Egypt, out of the house of bondage, for by strength of hand Yahweh brought you out from this place. There shall be no leavened bread be eaten. This day came you out of on the month Abib, and it shall be when Yahweh shall bring you into the land of the Canaanites, and the Hittites, and the Amorites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites, which he sware unto your fathers, to give thee a land flowing with milk and honey, that you shall keep this service in this month. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread, and in the seventh day shall be a feast to Yahweh. A Moedim, a special Moed, on the seventh day, a gathering of Yahweh's people. Unleavened bread shall be eaten 7 days, and there shall be no leavened bread be seen with you, neither shall there be leaven seen with you in all your quarters." We've been asked, well, can I take, you know, the bread out and put it out in the garage, and then when the feast is over, bring it back in? Or maybe give it to my neighbor for safekeeping. No, Yahweh says that isn't acceptable. We're to get rid of that leaven because that doesn't keep with the spirit of what we're doing. We're removing this leaven from our lives. "And you shall show your son in that day, saying, This is done because of that which Yahweh did unto me when I came forth out of Egypt. And it shall be a sign. It shall be for a sign unto you upon your hand and for the memorial between your eyes, that Yahweh's law may be in your mouth. For with a strong hand has Yahweh brought you out of Egypt. You shall therefore keep this ordinance in his season from year to year." So this brings us to the end of a week-long observance, this last high day of the feast. But this isn't the end of the story. As a matter of fact, only the beginning of Yahweh's annual Moedim and the redemption portrayed by Yahweh's feasts. If the world would understand what the feasts are all about, they would have a clearer understanding of what Yahweh's word is all about. If they would just go through each one, understand its meaning. Because there's a wealth of information in these feast days. And we get in tune with that, we have a much clearer vision of what Yahweh's planned. Today is the day of the first harvest cuttings, the wave sheaf, and the harvest of barley is beginning. The count toward the Feast of Weeks begins with this day. Let's turn to Leviticus 23. Leviticus 23 and verse 11 is the command. "And he shall wave the sheaf before Yahweh to be accepted for you. On the morrow after the Sabbath, the priest shall wave it." That's the weekly Sabbath. The priest is to wave this sheaf. What he did was he went like this, you know, to all corners. Not like this, but presented it to Yahweh, this sheaf of the barley, the first fruits of the barley. Yahshua presented himself as well to Yahweh after his resurrection. Remember when Mary came to him, thought he was the gardener? And he says, "Touch me not." Some versions say, "Don't hold on to me. I haven't yet ascended to my Father." So he became our wave sheaf, spiritually speaking. He had not yet ascended. And that same day at evening, then we find him standing there in the upper room with all the disciples and saying, "Shalom be unto you." Then he breathes on them and they receive the Spirit. Isn't that interesting? He breathed on them. the first fruits of the resurrection bestows the first fruits of the Spirit to the first fruits people. But it's more than just the 11 that receive that blessing. And that's what I want to focus on today. Let's turn to Luke chapter 24. Luke 24, verse 33, indicates there's an additional people there at that time. And they rose up in the same hour and returned to Jerusalem and found the 11 gathered together, of course, minus Judah, and found the 11 there, and them that were with them. We find in Acts 2, there was a bunch of people, remember at the Feast of Weeks, who were there, gathered from many nations, 15 nations there, keeping the feast of Pentecost, we call Pentecost. But here we have 11 and plus more people there. History likes to show everything happening only to the apostles, you know. You only see 12 normally following them around, and only just the Israelites leaving Egypt. But that isn't so. That's not the whole story. There were others. When the Exodus finally happened and Israel was released, we find another group going out with Israel. Let's turn to Exodus 12:38. In Exodus 12 here, there is a mention of a multitude. In fact, it calls it a mixed multitude. A mixed multitude went up also with the Israelites, and flocks and herds, even very much cattle. Some say these were of the lower social caste in Egypt. Some say they were slaves as well, who happened to be there from the other, you know, conquered nations who were there with Israel. Some say there were some directly from Egypt who had married with the Israelites. The Jewish Study Bible calls them riffraff. Whoever they were, they spelled trouble. In Exodus 12:49, we read, there was one law. One law shall be to him that is homeborn, and unto the stranger that sojourns among you. One law. One law. And that has continued down through the millennia, through the centuries. It doesn't say there's one law for Jews and one law for Christianity. And yet another law for unbelievers. It doesn't say there's a law for Jews and no law for Christians or unbelievers. It said there's one law for all people. This multitude could not take of the promises that were locked up in Yahweh's feast days. They could not partake of the Passover. The reason that only the circumcised, or in our case the immersed, are allowed to take the Passover is found in Exodus 12:43. And people wonder, why do we have that provision? Well, Yahweh has it. It says, and Yahweh said unto Moses and Aaron, this is the ordinance of the Passover. There shall no stranger eat thereof. But every man's servant that is bought for money, when you have circumcised him, then shall he eat thereof. A foreigner and a hired servant shall not eat thereof. In one house, one shall be eaten, that shall be eaten, and you shall not carry forth out of the flesh abroad out of the house, neither shall you break a bone thereof. All the congregation of Israel shall keep it. And when a stranger shall sojourn with you and will keep the Passover to Yahweh, let all his males be circumcised, and then let him come near and keep it. And he shall be as one that is born in the land, for no uncircumcised person shall eat thereof. No doubt there are many there who had not eaten of the Passover, had not learned the lessons. I'm talking about the riffraff, the mixed multitude that went with them. In Colossians 2, and we covered this during the Passover service, but how does that apply to us today, since circumcision, Shaul says, is nothing, and uncircumcision is nothing. Colossians 2 and verse 11. in whom also you are circumcised with a circumcision made without hands, in putting off the body of the sins of the flesh, by the circumcision of Messiah. And then it goes on in verse 12, explaining this, it says, buried with him in baptism, wherein also you are risen with him through the faith of the operation of Elohim, who has raised him from the dead. So immersion is that type of circumcision that we're undergoing today. And Yahweh said unto Moses and Aaron in 43 that this is the ordinance of the Passover, and no stranger was to eat thereof. Well, it's the mixed multitude that we read in the account that started to cause all the problems. The mixed multitude. And it didn't take much pushing to get Israel to fall right in line with their difficulty. Let's turn to Numbers chapter 11. The mixed multitude. Numbers chapter 11, verse 4. And a mixed multitude that was among them fell a-lusting, and the children of Israel also wept again and said, who shall give us flesh to eat? We remember the fish, which we did eat in Egypt freely, the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlic. And all those things grow in the dirt. That's where their mind was, in the dirt. But now our soul is dried away, for there is nothing at all beside this manna before our eyes. Then it goes on and says, the manna was as coriander seed, and the color thereof as the color of delium. And they went about and gathered it and ground it in mills, or beat it in mortar and baked it in pans and made cakes of it. And taste of it was like the taste of fresh oil. Sounds tasty to me. Sounds like almost like maybe fresh potato chips or something, you know. But much better, much better. And when dew fell on the camp in the night, the manna fell upon it. So it was moist and tasty, and the people didn't want it. They wanted more. They wanted something else. Because the mixed multitude got them to lusting after meat and some of the other provisions that were, you know, commonplace in Egypt. And what a lesson we find in this. Because the bread of life is all that's needed, isn't it? Yahshua the Messiah. But for Israel, incited by this mixed multitude, they were not satisfied. It started with a few and it grew. Kind of like our old leaven, doesn't it? Sound like it. And it started to get worse and worse, and the nation grumbled. And this was the working of a corrupt leavening. They wanted variety. They wanted delicious tenderloin with all the trimmings. They wanted chicken too, and they wanted fish. In effect, they wanted all that they had in Egypt. They didn't want to leave Egypt. They wanted to bring Egypt with them. I've often wondered, why didn't they just go out and, you know, go to their flocks and make some steaks from all the cattle they had? What's going on here? Why are they complaining? Maybe they were spoiled by the fact that Yahweh automatically every day provided their food. Every day they have to go out. There it is, right there laying on the ground. Pick it up and eat it. Maybe they just want him to supply it for them so they didn't have to do any work. I don't know. He kept giving them more and more, and so they expected more and more. All of this was motivated by a group of people that were not even Israelites. But then the Israelites started thinking the same way. They didn't understand the plan. I'm going to turn to Nehemiah chapter 13. What happens when a mixed multitude starts influencing us? Well, let's find out what happened back here in Nehemiah. Because the mixed multitude can be very persuasive, can cause us to be influenced. And it did here, even back in Nehemiah's time, chapter 13. This chapter really finalizes Nehemiah's reforms that he did, and to bring true worship back, you know, and to return an obedient people back to Yahweh. In verse chapter 13 and verse 3, we read, "Now it came to pass, when they had heard the law, that they separated from Israel all the mixed multitude." Because they read Deuteronomy 23, 3 to 6, and says mixed multitude had to be separated out. And this leaves me with a question. Why didn't Moses do this to begin with? I mean, he understood the law. He got the law from Yahweh. Why weren't they already taken out? Maybe it was the hardness of people's hearts. He allowed it. I don't know. But it wasn't lawful because Yahweh says they were to be separated or they're going to cause problems. Well, we have big problems in Nehemiah 13. And you have to wonder, what influence did the mixed multitude have on the situation? Many in the world, you know, can pull down our dedication. We get mixed up in the thinking of the world and the things the world does, and we start to lose sight of Yahweh. And they can adversely affect our dedication. They pull us down. They want us to do what's unlawful. Unbelieving spouse might try to get a spouse to, you know, break the Sabbath. Excuse me. To violate, you know, other laws of Yahweh. Friends can cause us to compromise one way or the other. Well, in chapter 13, Nehemiah, verse 4. "And before this, Eliashib, the priest, having the oversight of the chamber of the house of Yahweh, was allied," excuse me, "unto Tobiah. And he had prepared for him a great chamber where aforetime they laid the meat offerings, the frankincense, and the vessels, and the tithes of the corn, the new wine, and the oil, which was commanded to be given to the Levites, and the singers, and the porters, and the offerings of the priests. But in all this time was I not at Jerusalem, for in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, came I unto the king. And after certain days obtained I leave of the king." So he came to Jerusalem and understood this evil that Eliashib had done for Tobiah in preparing him a chamber in the courts of the house of Yahweh. What is going on here? The priest Eliashib had given Nehemiah's arch enemy the temple tithe storeroom to store his stuff, to bring his personal stuff in there and store it. Why? Well, obviously there wasn't any tithing going on. They had a big empty room. Nothing there. So he says, "Oh, okay, bring your stuff in here and you can store it here." Verse 10, or let's go look at let's back up again. Verse 8, "And it grieved me sore. Therefore I cast forth all of the household stuff of Tobiah out of the chamber." Get it out of there. It doesn't belong in Yahweh's temple area. "Then I commanded, and they cleansed the chambers, and thither brought I again the vessels of the house of Elohim with the meat offering and the frankincense. And I perceived that the portions of the Levites had not been given them, for the Levites and the singers that did the work were fled, every one to his field." Well, the tithing had stopped. Yahweh's law said that the Levites were to be supported by the tithe, and yet there was no tithe coming in, so they're out there farming land. Levites had to make a living. You know, they didn't have the tithe, so they're out there working in the world. He's very upset. "Then contended I with the rulers and said, why is the house of Yahweh forsaken? And I gathered them together and set them in their place. Then brought all Judah, the tithe of the corn and the new wine and the oil unto the treasuries. And I made treasuries over the treasuries." Treasurers over the treasuries. These different men. And next to them was Hannah, the son of Zakur, the son of Mattaniah, for they were counted faithful, and their office was to distribute unto their brethren. Remember me, O my Elohim, concerning this, and wipe not out my good deeds that I have done for the house of my Elohim and for the offices thereof. The Levites who had been given the command to work in the temple finally were restored to their jobs because the mechanism for support was brought back, the tithe. And then in verse 15, in those days saw I Judah, in Judah, some treading wine presses on the Sabbath. So we got a lot more problems going on here than just a room being housing a man's goods. He saw the Sabbath being broken, bringing in sheaves and lading asses, and also wine and grapes and figs and all manner of burdens, which they brought into Jerusalem on the Sabbath day. And I testified against them in that day, wherein they sold food. There dwelt men of Tyre also therein, which brought fish and all manner of ware, and sold on the Sabbath day. So we have some more mixed multitude in there. They're bringing their stuff in. They're selling fish on the Sabbath unto the children of Judah and Jerusalem. Then I commanded with the nobles of Judah and said unto them, what evil thing is this that you do and profane the Sabbath day? What in the world are you doing? Did not your fathers thus, and did not our Elohim bring this evil upon us and upon this city? Yet you bring more wrath upon Israel by profaning the Sabbath. I wonder how that happened. Probably like leaven, a little bit here, a little bit there. Some guy says, well, here, I'll go ahead and sell you this, but I haven't got it all. I'll bring some more tomorrow. Okay, well, go ahead and do that. Tomorrow happens to be the Sabbath. So he starts selling on the Sabbath. Some other guy sees that, I'll go do that too. I'll sell to Judah some goods that I have, and pretty soon it's just a regular old day. Exactly like it happens in our day. You know, they used to have blue laws. I don't know if there's any blue laws left in this country. They call them blue laws because they're written on blue paper, and that was to protect the day of the LORD from commerce, but that has gone by the wayside pretty much in most places. But even today, it's been recognized that the Sabbath, even though it's not Yahweh's Sabbath, but a special day was set apart for no commerce. Well, here Israel, or Judah, has got a problem. Well, Nehemiah's got to set it straight. These mixed multitudes that come in and perverted worship. And he says in verse 19, it came to pass that when the gates of Jerusalem began to be dark before the Sabbath, sunset was coming, I commanded that the gate should be shut and charged that they should not be opened until after the Sabbath. And some of my servants set I at the gates, that there should be no burden be brought in on the Sabbath day. They're just going to shut the doors. They can't get in. So the merchants and sellers of all kinds of ware lodged without Jerusalem once or twice. They hung around. Well, maybe we can still get in there and sell some things. I testified against them and said unto them, why do you lodge about the wall? If you do so again, I'll lay my hands on you. From that time forth came no more they on the Sabbath day. He says, we're going to stop this perversion of Yahweh's Sabbath. There's going to be no more, not just no more work, there's going to be no more commerce, because this is a day set apart for Yahweh. And I commanded the Levites that they should cleanse themselves and they should come and keep the gates to sanctify the Sabbath day. Then he has a petition to Yahweh. He says, remember concerning this and spare me according to your mercy. Then we got some more problems. This isn't all. No, Nehemiah's got a real cleaning job to do. A lot of leavening to be cleaned up here. He says in verse 23, in those days also I saw Jews that had married wives of Ashdod, of Ammon, and of Moab, and their children spake half in the speech of Ashdod, and could not speak in the Jews' language, but according to the language of each people. See what happens? They intermarried with the mixed multitude, so to speak. And pretty soon, they couldn't even speak Hebrew anymore. They were speaking all the other languages. And they'd forgotten their own language. And that's just a start. I mean, no doubt, there was all sorts of other things going on that were against Yahweh's law once they made these bonds with the pagans around them. And I contended with them and cursed them and smote certain of them and plucked off their hair. This guy is hot. He's tearing their hair and everything else, trying to get them to quit this stuff and turn them around, you know. And I made them swear by Elohim, saying, you shall not give your daughters unto the sons, nor take their daughters unto your sons, or for yourselves. Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin by these things? Yet among many nations there was no king like him, who was beloved of his Elohim. And Elohim made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, even him did outlandish women cause to sin. Shall we then hearken unto you to do all this great evil, to transgress against our Elohim in marrying strange wives? And one of the sons of Jehoiada, the son of Elishaba, the high priest, was son-in-law to Sanballat the Horonite. Therefore I chased him from me. Remember, this guy is a man of hands-on type action. He didn't just say it. I mean, he goes after him. He's going to lay hands on him. He's probably some big burly, you know, prophet who wouldn't put up with anything. So he has a job to do. Verse 30, then, thus cleansed I from all strangers and appointed the wards of the priests and the Levites, everyone in his business, and for the wood offerings at times appointed and for the first fruits. He ends it with, remember me, O my Elohim, for good, for doing what was right. It always amazed me. Israel, you know, would have a good king. Then they have two or three bad kings. Then they have another good king, returning him back to the, you know, Yahweh's truth. Then they have a battered king or two. Maybe even his father was bad, but he was good. I mean, you see this back and forth, but mostly the bad outweighed the good. And this man is struggling with this problem, trying to correct things and get him back because of all the leaven that had been come in and not been dealt with through the mixed multitude. And I think a lot of this had to do with Israel's apostasy when they allowed the foreigners to come in. They had been leavened, and had these people accepted the truth, had they accepted the covenant, done what was required, you know, be like becoming circumcised and joining the promises, the story would be a lot different from them. These nobodies, these mixed multitude, had a chance. You know, they came out with Israel. And that's the lesson we get in the new covenant. The others can be grafted in, Romans 9 and 11, and grafted into the promise and take hold of it too. These people could have done the same thing. Yahweh was ready to give them the blessings even the Israelites had if they would obey him. But the mixed multitude took another path, and that one, which seemed right to them, passed them right out of the pages of the scriptures and history itself. Let's turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Lest some might think, well, yeah, that's just an old story. The Old Testament speaking, and we're now in a different age, a new covenant. They may believe that this is just good to talk about, but doesn't really have any significance. In 1 Corinthians 10, it says, moreover, brethren, I would not that you should be ignorant how that all our fathers were under the cloud and all passed through the sea, and were all baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea. I had a question 2 weeks ago. Someone said, can you show me baptism in the Old Testament? Why does it just seem to be in the New Testament? Well, there are several examples. Here's one of them, where we're told that they went into that sea and the sea basically was all around them, just as baptism covers, overwhelms. So it was a type of baptism. Of course, the mikvah we saw in the movie the other day, the mikvah, the ritualistic washings that the priests had to go through at the temple, was a type of cleansing in water, same type of idea. It's interesting that when the Pharisees and all the religious leaders saw John the Baptist out there baptizing, they didn't say, what strange rite are you doing here, John? They didn't think anything of it. They saw it as a cleansing, a regular type of mikvah for the whole entire person. They didn't, you know, fight him on it. Anyway, and did eat all the same spiritual meat, and did all drink the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed him. That rock was Messiah. So we have Yahshua guiding them and being with them and giving them drink back in the Old Testament. But with many of them, Yahweh was not well pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. Notice verse 6. Now these things were our examples, to the intent we should not lust after evil things, as they also lusted. He says, don't be idolaters as some of them were. The people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Neither let us commit fornication as some of them committed and fell in one day 23,000. Can you imagine? 23,000 people one day. Neither let us tempt Messiah as some of them also tempted and were destroyed as serpents. Neither murmur you as some of them also murmured and were destroyed of the destroyer. Verse 11. Make a little link in your Bible to verse 6. 6 and 11. Now all these things happen unto them for examples. And they are written for our admonition upon whom the ends of the world are come. Old Testament basis for our faith right here. Spoken twice by the apostle. Linking us with what happened there. When Israel left Egypt, they left their leavening behind, didn't they? Just as we sometimes find leavening that we missed. I think Brother Jose mentioned that in his prayer. Some of the leavening that might we thought we had it all out, but found out we had some sitting there. And of course, that's the biggest lesson that we can learn, is that when we think we got it, there's always something else that we need to work on. Israel brought along a different kind of leaven, however, the mixed multitude, a spiritual leaven that was really going to work at them. The worldly and sinful, mixed in like leaven among the people of Israel, caused them eventually to defy Yahweh and murmur against him and say, why did you bring us out here? No doubt these people were saying it all along to the Israelites. You know, they didn't have that bond with Yahweh. And Israel as well, you know, was very weak. They had just put the blood of the Lamb around their door, covered them, you know, covered their sins. Then they had to eat the unleavened bread for 7 days, seven being the number of spiritual perfection. But what were they doing when they were removing, taking away the leavening? What were they taking away with this unleavened bread? Let's turn to Matthew chapter 13. I don't think we defined exactly the specifics of leavening this year as we normally do at this time for the feast. So I think it's good that we do. Matthew 13. In Matthew 13, Yahshua gave a parable of a woman who had hid leaven in three measures. And we find that in verse 33. Another parable spake he unto them. The kingdom of heaven is like unto leaven, which a woman took and hid in three measures of meal, till the whole was leavened. And that's all we read. That's it on the parable. What does that mean? Well, we know that a woman in Scripture normally represents an assembly. It can be good or bad, but Revelation 12:6 shows us that. So here we have a woman who hid three measures of meal in a lump, in a chunk of, you know, a big glob of dough. I remember my grandmother making bread, and she'd sit there and she'd knead it, you know, and she'd flip it over and add more, you know, and how they do that. And over and over, it'd take like about a half hour, it seems, to go through this process. And then she'd come back and add a little more and then put it in the oven, and you'd look at it, you know, and the smell would start to, oh boy, was that good. And you'd look, peek in there, and it would start to, you know, barely see it go a little bit. Real slow. I mean, you really can't see it rise. I mean, it doesn't poof, you know. So you sit and you watch, and gradually it starts filling out like a loaf of bread. And you just can't wait to eat it. Can't wait to get into it. But that's how leaven works. It's slow, and this woman put it in this three measures, as a matter of fact, till the whole was leavened. And it's a parable. So if the woman is an assembly and she's putting something in and making it spread, then we can look back at the verses before. He's talking about another parable in the context. He says, the kingdom of heaven is like a grain of mustard seed, which a man took and sowed in his field, which indeed is the least of all seeds, but when it is grown, it is the greatest among herbs and becomes a tree, so that the birds of the air come and lodge in the branches thereof. The kingdom grows, is really what he's saying here. And then he goes on and talks about a woman putting leavening in. It grows. It spreads. A woman, an assembly, The assembly grows. It spreads. It gets larger. So here we have leavening as a symbol of growth of the kingdom, both in two parallel parables Yahshua brings out of growth. Leavening, you see, is not always bad. We think of leavening, well, you got to get it out. You know, it's just, oh, there it is. Well, during the Feast of Unleavened Bread, yeah, we have to get it out. But it's not always a bad thing. If we examine it, in this context, we see that it's a good thing. It's spreading, making the kingdom, so to speak, grow. Because it's commanded in the wave sheaf offering as well, the wave loaves, I should say, not the wave sheaf, the wave loaves of Pentecost, and also the peace offering, Leviticus 7:13. So we can't say that leavening is always bad. It could be, you know, something important, another lesson we can learn from it. But leaven also, and this usually is the case, it depicts characteristics that can be detrimental. And it's linked to a puffing up nature. And let's turn to Matthew 16 as long as we're here in verse 11. Let's define what leaven is. Matthew 16 verse 11 says, "How is it that you do not understand that I spake it not to you concerning bread, that you should beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the scribes?" What is the leavening of Pharisees and scribes? Look at the next verse. "Then understood they how he bade them not be aware of the leaven of bread, but of the doctrine of the Pharisees and of the Sadducees." Bad doctrine, unscriptural teachings. This is what Yahshua battled in his whole career here on earth, basically, is the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees. It's the false teachings. Let's look at Luke chapter 12, verse 1. Again, find another definition for leavening. We've got false teachings right now, and that can lead to all sorts of things. That can lead to sin, of course. Some people think leavening is sin, but it's more than that. It's things that cause us to do things that lead to sin. 12:1 of Luke. "In the meantime, when there were gathered together an innumerable multitude of people, insomuch that they trode upon one another, he began to say unto the disciples, First of all, beware you of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. For there is nothing covered that should not be revealed, neither hid that shall not be known." So the Pharisees had a problem with hypocrisy. They were hypocrites. Say one thing, do another. Cause people to do things that they wouldn't do. They've got all sorts of ways they manipulate for political purposes. And that brings us to the third, over in Mark 8. A third definition. We've got false teachings. We've got hypocrisy, which is what the Pharisees and the Sadducees were characteristic of. And in Mark 8:15, "And he charged them, saying, Take heed, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and of the leaven of Herod." Oh, who's that? Why do we bring Herod into this? Well, some of the translations says it's speaking of the Herodians. The Herodians, which were a political movement at the time that was instrumental in scheming with the Pharisees, even to arrest Yahshua. Malice and wickedness. They were defending their empire. They were defending their politics. And they wanted to get rid of Yahshua. He was a threat. He said he was a king, they said, and we got to get rid of him. He was a threat to their power. So here we have malice and wickedness entering in as a type of leavening. I notice that Pharisees pretty much is described in every one of these, isn't it? Yahshua really did not get along too well with the Pharisees, did he? In fact, it was their teachings that caused the problems that we still have today, because people think he threw out the law. All he was doing, basically, is showing how the Pharisees had twisted everything and caused, through their own man-made additions, to make people keep laws that weren't laws. They were additions to the laws. And Yahshua had to show them and show them the correct as well application of Yahweh's law to our lives. And these people had it all twisted up. They were so far afield of understanding what Yahweh's law was all about that they were using it for their own purposes and worrying about the nitpicky aspects and bringing them, you know, into a huge emphasis, which was not what Yahshua said. He wanted them to do the weightier matters of the law, you know, justice, love, peace, mercy, these sort of things. They had everything askew, all mixed up. Yahweh has chosen for us to live among a mixed multitude, brethren, and we work out our salvation here on earth in the same way that Israel was to do so with their mixed multitude. And the danger, of course, is falling into the same trap. We see the operation of leaven out there every day, don't we? Every day we get it. Our world is filled with it, with error, with malice, wickedness, hypocrisy, all these things. False teachings. Paul faced the same issues with the world that we do today. There's nothing new when it comes to human nature. Let's turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 19. He says, "For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise and will bring to nothing the understanding of the prudent." Where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the disputer of this world? Has not Yahweh made foolish the wisdom of this world? For after that, in the wisdom of Elohim, the world by wisdom knew not Elohim. It pleased Yahweh by the foolishness of preaching to save them that believed. For the Jews require a sign, and the Greeks seek after wisdom. The Greeks were up there just every day trying to find some new thing to talk about. Their philosophy is where a lot of error that we get today started with, is the Greeks and their thinking. Plato and so forth, well, he brought in. He says, "But we preach Messiah impaled unto the Jews a stumbling block," and it still is a stumbling block, "and unto the Greeks foolishness. But unto them which are called, both Jews and Greeks, Messiah the power of Elohim and the wisdom of Elohim. Because the foolishness of Yahweh is wiser than men, and the weakness of Elohim is stronger than men. For you see your calling, brethren, how that not many wise men after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble, are called." How many doctors, lawyers, and Indian chiefs do we have sitting here? Yep, bears it right out, doesn't it? We're all just common folk working for Yahweh, doing what we can to seek that goal of salvation. Because those that are in a different stratus and status have other desires, other goals in their life. They don't have time to search out the truth of Yahweh. They're too busy. So that obviously they're not going to be brought into that calling that Yahweh has. He wants those who would humble themselves and, you know, come to him in faith and not rely on their own wisdom, their own wealth, whatever it might be. He says, "For you see your calling, brethren, how that not many wise." And then he says, verse 27, "But Elohim has chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise. And Elohim has chosen the weak things of the world to confound the things which are mighty." We were watching that debate, that video about the man who was debating evolution, creation, I should say, as opposed to evolution. And what I noticed is I watched the professor, and he was, you know, deal with the issue. He never even dealt with the issue. You notice that? And that's how the wisdom of the world works. They get you way off in some tangent, and you get so, you know, mixed up, you don't even know what they're saying. Instead of getting down to basics and saying, you know, why does X, Y, and Z equal W? Well, they aren't going to do that. They're going to talk about philosophy and talk about terms that we've never maybe encountered before and get everybody confused. Yahweh says these are foolish things of the world to confound the wise. And Yahweh's chosen the weak things to confound the things which are mighty. And Yahweh always does that. He takes something small, as Yahshua said in his parable, you know, the the little seed that grows huge into a big tree. He takes the weakest letters of the Hebrew alphabet and makes them his name, Yod, Hey, and Wah. Those are the weakest letters. He always does that. He takes Yahshua from a baby. You know, he didn't come in, you know, with 10,000 legions of angels and, you know, give the world his plan. He starts with a baby. Trouble is, the world keeps him as a baby, you know. It keeps him weak. Comes out as in a manger, and the only power he has, it seems, he's left there on a tree, nailed to a tree, and can't do anything. You know, he's kept weak, but that's not in Yahweh's plan. He's going to be coming back to this earth in power and glory, and he's going to take over. And he says, the base things of the world and the things which are despised has Yahweh chosen, yea, and things which are not to bring to naught things that are, that no flesh should glory in his presence. Today we see in this world worship of self. That's all it is. What Yahweh can do for me and the power that I have. And I can bind this and that. And I. And Yahweh says, no flesh should glory in his presence. It's nothing. We are nothing in his presence. You stand back and you look at this little dot of a planet out here in billions of galaxies and billions and trillions of stars, and you think on this little dot, there's little dots running around, which is, you know, us. How important are we, you know? But we are to Yahweh. And those who will follow him are very important because they're going to be in his family, right there, serving him for an eternity. And that's what the feasts are all about, that plan that Yahweh has. Learning to overcome through the blood of Yahshua at Passover and then taking out when it offends him in our lives. And then going on. Pentecost, which is the time when Israel had reached Sinai and he gave him his laws, codified them. And then, of course, the feast of the seventh month, we have the return of Yahshua and establishing of his kingdom. So Yahweh has his plan. He says in verse 30, but of him are ye and Messiah Yahshua, who of Elohim has made unto us wisdom and righteousness and sanctification and redemption, that according as it is written, he that glories, let him glory in Yahweh. What a fitting, I think, summation of what Yahweh has for his people here through his feasts. He calls humble people. He wants those who are willing to give up whatever it might be for the better sake of the kingdom. Just as there's a right action of leaven, there's a right kind of glorying too, if it's directed to Yahweh and not ourselves. Consider that Yahweh took and exalted Israel after they had been in Egypt 430 years in slavery. Talk about a humbling experience. He took them because they were weak and humble, and brought them out to work with them. And that's what he looks for in his people. They had to want to give up the ways of Egypt, the ways of the world. They've had enough of it. And they had to grow sick of the oppression and the evil that the worldly structure had put them under. They had to learn humility. They had to be unleavened. The mixed multitude have a warning for us today. It says in Hebrews 4:2, for indeed the good news was preached to us as well as to them. But the word which they heard did not profit them, not being mixed with faithfulness. So they died in the wilderness like those unbelieving Israelites, missing the blessings and the promises that they were supposed to have a part in. As we leave this feast, I hope we remember the lessons that we learned, the lessons of leaven and what it does to us. And how it can spread. And it comes to a point where we don't even realize it's there. You know, like a loaf of bread. I mean, we don't think about leaven. It's all puffed up and already used up. We don't even think about it. But to get rid of those things that offend in our lives. If there's anything in our lives that is not right, this feast is the time to correct it, to root it out. Maybe we have a problem with greed. Maybe we have a problem with vanity. Maybe we have a problem with envy. Whatever it might be, this is the time to root it out, to get out of it, get rid of it. Maybe we can't love as we should. We need to change that and ask Yahweh's help if we are constantly burdened with that. I want to turn to Hebrews chapter 3. Hebrews chapter 3, I want to read the admonition here in verse 12. Take heed. This is talking about backsliding. I mean, we come to the pinnacle. We got to stay up there. We don't want to backslide, and that's so hard sometimes. He says, "Take heed, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living Elohim. But exhort one another daily while it is called today, lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of leaven." I stuck leaven in there. It's deceitfulness of sin. But I think leaven fits in there just as well, because it's all part of the same thing. Those who failed to enter Canaan were those who had heard Yahweh's promises but refused to believe it. They simply rebelled. They disobeyed. So Yahweh closed the doors on a whole generation of people. He said only those 20 and below are going to come in. Imagine all that they had gone through. The plagues in Egypt. You know, the first three plagues they had to undergo too? The pillar of fire that led them out during the night. And the cloud by day. The parting of the water, the drowning of the Egyptians. All those things that they saw. They saw Yahweh working. The manna. Every day, right there on the ground, go out and pick it up. Boy, it was good. Sweet, tasted good. Shoes and clothing that never wore out? Come on, what more do you need to realize that Yahweh is there working? How many more miracles does it take to convince people that he's sovereign, that he's there? These people were like the spoiled brat, you know, who says, "What else can you do for me?" That's basically what they were like. Prompted by a mixed multitude, no doubt. So what do we do? Do we let the world do that to us, or we take a stand? Do we have the faith that it takes to overcome? Do we let the world influence our stand? Do we say, "No, I'm going to obey Yahweh"? You want to know about him? Let me tell you about him. Or do we change with the times? Do we flow with the mixed multitude? Just consider the action of leaven as it puffs up and how it permeates, changing it. The same could happen to us in our own spiritual lives if we don't learn the lessons of unleavened bread. And believe me, there are people who have come to this knowledge that you have and really understand the truth who have turned back. And that's such a tragedy, because Hebrews 6 tells us there's no more sacrifice. Once you give it up, that's it. You can't impale Yahshua all over again. 1 Corinthians 5, this was a passage that Paul wrote during the Feast of Unleavened Bread. He wrote to the Corinthians because they got a problem. They got some leavening starting to grow. He says, "It reported commonly that there is fornication among you, such fornication as not so much as named among the Gentiles, that one should have his father's wife," probably stepmother. "And you are puffed up and have not rather mourned, that he that has done this deed should be taken away from among you. For I verily, as absent in body but present in spirit, have judged already, as though I were present, concerning him that has done this thing. In the name of our master Yahshua, when you are gathered together in my spirit, with the power of our master Yahshua, to deliver such an one unto Satan for the destruction of the flesh, that the spirit may be saved in the day of the master Yahshua." He said, get rid of this sin. Get rid of it now. "Your glorying is not good. Know you not that a little leaven leavens the whole lump?" We see the exact same type of thing happening in a big denomination today, where they're ordaining a man who's so unfit for the priesthood. It's an abomination to Yahweh, and they're letting that leaven in, and it's going to start to grow. And once they get away with that, then the rest of them are going to fall in too. We're going to see such a perversion in this world. You know, Yahshua's going to come back, but he's going to have to do a whole lot of setting things right just as old Nehemiah had to start from scratch and take hold, hands on, get rid of this sin. We're going to see 11 take over in our world, such as we've never seen before. He says, purge out therefore the old leaven, that you may be a new lump, as you are unleavened, for you, Messiah, our Passover, is sacrificed for us. Let us therefore keep the feast, not with the old leaven, neither with a leaven of malice and wickedness. There's some more definitions for us. But with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. Sincerity and truth. When we leave here, let's keep that in mind. But our goal is to be sincere and to follow the truth in everything we do. That's what Yahweh's looking for. Sincerity and truth. Nothing gets in the way. Nothing comes between us and Yahweh. And that's what it's all about, brethren, following the footsteps of Yahshua. We saw how he had gone through all sorts of trials and all sorts of beatings, physical, just unbelievable, what he had to endure. But nothing was going to get between. Any time he could have said, I give up, it's not worth it. But he kept going. And that's what we need to do. Even though it gets difficult, even though we face those trials, you know, there's always the down and then the up. We get down, we feel low, and in a day or two, things seem to change, and, you know, things are better again. Yahweh says he won't give you more than you can handle. So let's pray for that we get strength in those times when we're down and seem to have difficulties, because we know we can trust in Yahweh to bring us out of it, and he will, if we keep that leavening out of our lives and trust in sincerity and truth. May Yahweh bless you. Hallelujah.